The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. An Introduction. It was not always to be called The Great Gatsby. In a letter to Maxwell Perkins, Fitzgerald wrote, "I have now decided to stick to the title I put on the book, Trimalcio in West Egg, circa the 7th of November 1924. Trimalcio is, of course, the vulgar social upstart of immense wealth in the satricon of Petronius, a master of sexual and gastronomic revels, who gives a banquet of unimaginable luxury, in which, unlike Gatsby, who is a non-drinking, self-isolating spectator at his own parties, he most decidedly participates. He is a most literal glutton, while Gatsby stands at a curious distance from all he owns and displays. Just as at times he seems to stand back from his own words and consider them appraisingly, as he would the words of another, just as he will display shirts he has never worn, books he has never read, and extend invitations to swim in the pool he has never used." If Fitzgerald thought of Gatsby as some sort of American Trimalcio thrown up by the riotous license of the 20s, he certainly subjected him to some remarkable metamorphosis. He is called Trimalcio just once in the novel. But there are some distant genealogical traces of Gatsby's ancient ancestor. In the Satricon, Trimalcio is first mentioned in the conversation of two friends discussing where that night's feast is to be held. "Do you know at whose house it is today?" Trimalcio, a very rich man who has a clock and a uniformed trumpeter in his dining room to keep telling him how much of his life is lost and gone. Gatsby's concerned with time, its arrestability, recuperability, repeatability, is equally obsessive, as was Fitzgerald's, he seemed to write surrounded by clocks and calendars, said Malcolm Cowley. One of the punctilious, Gatsby's few clumsy physical movements, nearly results in the breaking of a clock. No doubt in some corner of his being, he would like to break them all. The obsession is partly the Trimalcian fear of transience. There is always too little time left. More grandly, if more foolishly, it comes from some deep refusal to accept the linear irreversibility of history. "Banish the uniformed trumpeter," would be Gatsby's cry. "I will not hear his flourish." When Gatsby's illustrious forebear, Trimalcio, is first seen, he is busily engaged with a green ball. He never picked it up if it touched the ground. Gatsby comes to orient his life in relation to not a green ball, but a green light. "You always have a green light that burns all night at the end of your dock," he says to Daisy. Seen from across the water and everything else that separates him from Daisy, the green light offers Gatsby a suitably inaccessible focus for his yearning, something to give definition to desire, while indefinitely deferring consummation, something to stretch his arms towards, as he does, rather than circle his arms around, as he tries to. The fragile magic of the game depends on keeping the green light at a distance, or we might say, on keeping the green ball in the air. The green ball, fallen to the ground, would be too much of a reminder of that ineluctable gravity that pulls all things back to the earth, balls and dreams alike. Likewise, with the annulment of distance, lights too closely approached may well lose their supernal lustre and revert to unarousing ordinariness. You can wish only on the star you can't reach. Daisy put her arm through his abruptly, but he seemed absorbed in what he had just said. Possibly, it had occurred to him that the colossal significance of that light had now vanished forever. Compared to the great distance that had separated him from Daisy, it had seemed as close as a star to the moon. Now it was again a green light on a dock. His count of enchanted objects had diminished by one. Possibly and possibly not. Or possibly something different. Certainly in this book, there is abroad a hunger for enchanted objects, a taste for the colossal, and a concern to try to establish and differentiate those times, moments, configurations, when a light might be a star of colossal significance, as opposed to just another dock light. This is Nick Carraway's version, and we may wonder whether, in retrospect, The green light didn't shine more brightly for him, even than, possibly, for Gatsby. Of the many exotic courses served at Trimalcio's banquet, I want to single out one. A tray was brought in with a basket on it, in which there was a hen made of wood, spreading out her wings as they do when they are sitting. The music grew loud. Two slaves came up and at once began to hunt in the straw. Peahen's eggs were pulled out and handed to the guests. We took our spoons and hammered at the eggs, which were balls of fine meal. I was on the point of throwing away my portion. I thought a peachick had already formed. But hearing a practiced diner say, "What treasure have we here?" I poked through the shell with my finger and found a fat baccafascio rolled up in spiced yolk of egg. In October 1922, the Fitzgeralds moved to a house in Great Neck, Long Island, on a peninsula at the foot of Manhasset Bay. Their house was a relatively modest one compared with the opulent summer homes of the seriously rich old American families, the Guggenheims, the Astors, the Van Nostrands, the Pulitzers, on another peninsula across the bay. This, of course, provided Fitzgerald with the basis topography for his novel. New Money Gatsby and No Money Nick on one side of the bay, and Old Money Buchanan's on the other. But what is old money in America? In the course of being transposed into the novel, the necks became eggs. 20 miles from the city, a pair of enormous eggs, identical in contour and separated only by a courtesy bay, jut out into the most domesticated body of salt water in the Western Hemisphere, the great, wet barnyard of Long Island Sound. They are not perfect ovals, like the egg in the Columbus story. They are both crushed flat at the contact end, but their physical resemblance must be a source of perpetual wonder to the gulls that fly overhead. To the wingless, a more interesting phenomenon is their dissimilarity in every peculiar except shape and size. A deep generating question behind the whole book is just this. As a result of the domestication of the great wild continent discovered by Columbus, what has been hatched from it? What will you find if you take your spoon to the great egg, or is it eggs, of America? A disgusting, aborted, stunted, and stillborn thing, fit only to be thrown away? Or a treasure, something special? Baccafascio, a small bird, was considered a great delicacy, and marvellous and rare. Are the true products of America as dissimilar as the two eggs might suggest? With the East Egg Buchanans representing and embodying the sort of devouring, self-pleasuring, and hypocritical materialism that the stupendous and ruthless success of 19th century capitalism fostered and enabled. And the West Egg Alliance of Nick and Gatsby holding out for the possibility, the necessity, of that something else, something more, which materialism can never satisfy. A nostalgic yearning for some sort of ideal that refuses to concede any absolute dominion to the merely accidental triumphs of the matter and matters of the day. From this point of view, if you went back far enough into American history, then archetypally, Benjamin Franklin was the driving genius of East Egg, while Jonathan Edwards would be the tutelary spirit of West Egg. This is a comprehensible and justifiable reading of the striking dissimilarity of two of the more striking types hatched by America. Nick himself speaks of the bizarre and not a little sinister contrast between the two eggs. But in his own terms, this is the perspective of the wingless. Seen from a sufficiently soaring height, it is their resemblance that is a source of perpetual wonder. This novel will indeed concern itself with dissimilarities and resemblances, and there is no disputing the differing aspirations and fates of the necessarily wingless protagonists. But near the end, Nick makes a summarising statement. "I see now that this has been a story of the West. After all, Tom and Gatsby, Daisy and Jordan, and I were all Westerners, and perhaps we possessed some deficiency in common which made us subtly unadaptable to Eastern life." Is there a Buchanan egg and a Gatsby egg? This one an abortion, that one a treasure? or allowing for mutations and variations, does the barnyard produce only one animal? It depends, perhaps, on how high you fly, how far away you stand, which points to a crucial matter raised by the book, what is and is not distorted vision. What mixture of proximity and distance affords the best, the most appropriate perception? How should Nick look at what he has seen? In Winter's Dreams, a story Fitzgerald wrote in 1922, Dexter Green is the son of a grocery store owner in Minnesota, a quick, alert, Midwestern lad, who is unconsciously dictated to by his winter dreams. The winters are characteristically dismal. The dreams, reactively, turn towards intimations of the gorgeous. But do not get the impression, because his winter dreams happened to be concerned at first with musings on the rich, that there was anything merely snobbish in the boy. He wanted not association with glittering things and glittering people. He wanted the glittering things themselves. Often, he reached out for the best without knowing why he wanted it. And sometimes, he ran up against the mysterious denials and prohibitions in which life indulges. He made money. It was rather amazing. Dexter Green is an embryonic Gatsby, and we may note a rather curious distinction on which the narrator insists. Not association with glittering things and glittering people, but the glittering things themselves. Not association, but possession. But what would, or could, or might it be, to possess a glittering thing or a glittering person? Can the attempt to go beyond association into appropriation ever not encounter denials and prohibitions? These are tacit questions that will haunt the later novel. Like many aspiring children of immigrant parents, Dexter cannot afford to be natural and spontaneous, for that might betray something of his peasant origin. He assembles himself as he assembles his wardrobe, with care. He recognised the value to him of such a mannerism, and he had adopted it. This is to build the self from the outside, as it were. The result is successful. He made money. It was amazing. But vulnerable and precarious. The more he gets, the less he has. On one level, he simply allows himself to be ensnared and enthralled and used and abandoned by a heedless, capricious, whimsical, dizzy, shallow rich girl, Judy Jones, who announces and reveals herself in her smile, radiant, blatantly artificial, convincing, like Gatsby's smile. But she is perhaps no more artificial, self-constructed than Dexter himself, and we might think of it as a matter of artifice reaching out and responding to artifice. We might, a little, think of Gatsby and Daisy that way too. For Dexter, it is simply immaterial whether Judy is sincere or acting when she again takes him up before she again lets him down. No illusion as to the world in which she had grown up could cure his illusion as to her desirability. It might seem as though Judy is the glittering thing, person, of his winter dreams, but in a curious way, she is a rather incidental figure, almost a function around which he can assemble and indulge a personal lexicon of ineffable glitteringness. Beautiful, romantic, gorgeous, ecstasy, magic of nights, fire and loveliness. His relationship is with these words more than with her. Early in their relationship, he says to her, "I'm nobody. My career is largely a matter of futures." But, and this is the other, more important level of his relationship with her, his future is largely a matter of pasts. As a boy, Dexter was a caddy. Now, a wealthy young man, he can afford caddies of his own when he goes golfing. But he keeps glancing at them, trying to catch a gleam or gesture that would remind him of himself, that would lessen the gap which lay between his present and his past. The greatest intensity of feeling comes not from possession, but from intimation of imminent or actual loss. "Fairer through fading," writes Emily Dickinson, "glittering because going." Fitzgerald implies, It was a mood of intense appreciation, a sense that for once, he was magnificently attuned to life, and that everything about him was radiating a brightness and a glamour he might never know again. Glittering because the radiance is about to dim. And when it has dimmed, and the world seems definitively deglamorized, then emotionally, the only future that matters really is the past. The story concludes with an incident that occurs many years after Dexter has resigned himself to the fact that Judy had disappeared from his life. From a chance encounter, Dexter learns that Judy has married a boor who drinks and runs around, shades, or rather imitations, of Tom Buchanan, that she probably loves him, and that her looks have gone. Squalor and degradation all around, in other words. And now Dexter feels a further loss. The dream was gone. Something had been taken from him. In a sort of panic, he pushed the palms of his hands into his eyes and tried to bring up a picture of the waters lapping on Sherry Island and the moonlit veranda, and gingham on the golf links and the dry sun, and the gold colour of her neck's soft down, and her mouth damp to his kisses, and her eyes plaintive with melancholy, and her freshness like new linen in the morning. Why, these things were no longer in the world. They had existed, and they existed no longer. For the first time in years, the tears were streaming down his face, but they were for himself now. He did not care about mouth and eyes and moving hands. He wanted to care, and he could not care. For he had gone away and he could never go back any more. The gates were closed, the sun was down, and there was no beauty but the grey beauty of steel that withstands all time. Even the grief he could have borne was left behind in the country of illusion, of youth, of the richness of life, where his winter dreams had flourished. "Long ago," he said, "long ago there was something in me, but now that thing is gone. Now that thing is gone. That thing is gone. I cannot cry. I cannot care. That thing will come back no more." This is a very young man's prose, and such a plongeant lament, for not only loss, but also the loss of the sense of loss, comes across as barely post-adolescent. I quote the passage at length partly to suggest how much Fitzgerald had to excise, or, let us say, otherwisely to absorb, before he could achieve the perfect tonal command of The Great Gatsby. One feels here, as so often with Fitzgerald's earlier writing, that the author has very imperfectly distanced himself from the emotional turbulence of his own autobiography. He needed to put something, someone, between himself and his writing, if he was to avoid ending up in a sentimental cul-de-sac. The passage also reveals, in coet form, an insight that I believe is absolutely central to Fitzgerald's work, namely, that the American dream, whatever one takes that phrase to mean, is not an index of aspiration, but a function of deprivation. But as Gatsby shows, there can be another turn to the screw. Dexter sinks rather wallowingly into his sense that his future is largely a matter of the past. Gatsby, too, recognises this, but he will not let the issue rest there, for he insists that the past can be turned into the matter of the future by someone who has made so much, including himself, and begone, the uniform trumpeter. It might interest you to know that a story of mine called Absolution was intended to be a picture of Gatsby's early life, but that I cut it because I prefer to preserve the sense of mystery. How much the stature of the Great Gatsby depends on what Fitzgerald cut out is a matter to which I will return. Here, we might consider what he had initially decided to write in as a crucial episode in Gatsby's childhood. 11-year-old Rudolf Miller, young Gatsby, has rebelled against his ineffectual father and been forced to attend confession during the course of which he lies. He has come to tell his story to Father Schwartz, to whom he admits that he is guilty of not believing I was the son of my parents. the fantasy Fitzgerald himself owned to, that I wasn't the son of my parents, but a son of a king who ruled the world. Exactly Freud's family romance. For the dismalness of being Rudolf Miller, he substitutes the gorgeousness of imagining himself to be Blatchford Sarmenington. When he became Blatchford Sarmenington, a suave nobility flowed from him. Blatchford Sarmenington lived in great sweeping triumphs, but he keeps the lie in the confessional to himself. Indeed, the secret lie, like the secret fantasy, comes to constitute his essential self. An invisible line has been crossed, and he became aware of his isolation, aware that it applied not only to those moments when he was Blatchford Sarmenington, but that it applied to all his inner life. Hitherto, such phenomena as crazy ambitions and petty shames and fears had been but private reservations, unacknowledged before the throne of his official soul. Now he realised, unconsciously, that his private reservations were himself, and all the rest a garnished front and a conventional flag. The pressure of his environment had driven him into the lonely secret world of adolescence. Effectively, the boy is rejecting his biological father and rebelling against his spiritual father, as if to say, most importantly, essentially, I am my private reservations, my refusals, my repudiations, my fantasies, and yes, my guilty lies. If you want me, don't ask for Rudolf Miller. Ask for Blatchford Sarmenington. Ask for Jay Gatsby. But the most interesting aspect of the story is the curiously disturbed state of Father Schwartz. I am not concerned here speculatively to relate this figure to such people as Father Sigourney Webster Fay, who undoubtedly had an important influence on Catholic Fitzgerald. André Levant had done this well in his biography. F. Scott's Fitzgerald, Penguin, 1983. At the start, the father is clearly disturbed by the hot madness of 4 o'clock, a terrible dissonance made up of the rustle of Swedish girls, yellow lights, sweet smells, and the Dakota wheat that is terrible to look on. After he has listened to the boy's story, the father breaks into a trembling monologue, which is distracted, if not deranged. When a lot of people get together in the best places, things go glimmering. The thing is to have a lot of people in the centre of the world, wherever that happens to be. Then, things go glimmering. My theory is that when a whole lot of people get together in the best places, things go glimmering all the time. Did you ever see an amusement park? It's a thing like a fair, only much more glittering. Go to one at night and stand a little way off from it in a dark place, under dark trees. You'll see a big wheel made of lights turning in the air, and a long slide shooting boats down into the water. A band playing somewhere, and a smell of peanuts, and everything will twinkle. But it won't remind you of anything, you see. It will all just hang out there in the night like a coloured balloon, like a big yellow lantern on a pole. But don't get up close, because if you do, you'll only feel the heat, and the sweat, and the life. These are, in fact, the dying words of the father, and we may take them as expressing his delirious regret for all the sexuality and glamour, the heat and light that, as a celibate priest, he has repressed and kept his distance from. But as the expression of an eager, tremulous excitement aroused by the thought, the sense, the apprehension of some kind of glittering glimmeringness, sexual and immaterial, incandescent and transcendent, generated by a foregathering of the beautiful and the blessed, or damned, the glamorous and the gorgeous, at a mythical and reachable centre, a heavenly amusement park. These words testify to a confused and inarticulate longing. For what? The light that never was on land or sea? that is somewhere at the heart of Fitzgerald's work, to be indulged or dealt with as the case may be. It is a sort of uninstructed Neoplatonism, gone somewhat berserk, amid the endless wheat, the untouchable girls, and the occasional brilliances of an otherwise dreary and dismal Middle West. But there is a crucial difference between Dexter Green's desire to possess the glittering things and Father Schwartz's advice to stand back from the glimmering light. And it lies precisely in the latter's apprehension that getting too close might be dangerous, ruinous to the vision of earthly and heavenly delights. Rudolph Sarmenington Gatsby is partly Green and partly Schwartz, and André Laveau has shown how careful Fitzgerald was with his colour ascriptions, of which more later. He thinks he can possess, repossess, the glittering girl. Indeed, he attempts to make his house into a glimmering, glamorous centre to attract her. "Your place looks like the World's Fair," says Nick to him, seeing his house lit from tower to cellar. We know that as a boy, Fitzgerald was very struck by the brilliance of the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo in 1901, where there was a goddess of light whose glow could be seen as far away as Niagara Falls. And Gatsby also uses the magic of electricity, he is after all a dedicated reader of Benjamin Franklin, to signal what he hopes and believes is a more than electrical glimmering. But for all the dedication of his quest for repossession, reenactment, he can enjoy, indeed, experience his desire and his dreams better at a distance. He is not really at home in the light he has himself turned on, and is more usually to be found, as the good father advised, standing a little way off it in a dark place. When he does get up close and encounters the heat and the sweat and life, particularly in the form of Tom Buchanan, the crude but confident snobbery of his discourse, the class-supported brashness of his hypocrisy, the brutality of his cruel body, Gatsby is indeed destroyed. The green is gone. All is Schwartz. Fitzgerald planned The Great Gatsby during the summer of 1922, but wrote it during the summer of 1924, while living on the Riviera. He crucially revised the proofs in Rome during January and February of the following year. This is just when Nick Carraway is writing his book about his summer with Gatsby of 2 years earlier, but he is back in the Midwest. Fitzgerald has introduced a narrator between himself and his omniscient indulgences. Fitzgerald's book is Nick's book, but Nick is not Fitzgerald. However many refracted biographical fragments we may imagine, we can discern. Nick is a character of confessedly limited literary abilities. He has written only a series of very solemn and obvious editorials for the Yale News. And while Nick is trying to write Gatsby, we are also reading Nick. Among writers he admired, Fitzgerald had plenty of precedents for the introduction of a narrator. Henry James, discussing how a writer can extract maximum significance from his material, stresses the value of sometimes choosing a particular kind of narrator. By so much as the affair matters for some such individual, by so much do we get the best there is of it. He points out the need for a reflecting and colouring medium, and adds, "We want it clear. Goodness knows, but we also want it thick. And we get the thickness in the human consciousness that entertains and records, that amplifies and interprets it. Prodigies, when they come straight, come with an effect imperiled. They keep all their character, on the other hand, by looming through some other history, the indispensable history of somebody's normal relation to something." Gatsby is a self-styled, self-styling prodigy of some sort, prodigiously criminal, prodigiously romantic, and Nick is, or so he would insist, nothing if not normal, though he would add, abnormally honest. Gatsby certainly looms, looms and fades, through Nick's history, and Nick certainly amplifies and interprets. Amplifies, we might come to think, quite inordinately. Joseph Conrad made some of his most important innovations in the art of fiction through the introduction and deployment of his sailor narrator Marlowe, particularly as Marlowe tries to put together a narrative that will somehow make sense of Lord Jim. Was Jim a coward or an idealist? Coward and idealist? What is the significance? What are the implications for us, as sailors, as British, as decent and reliable white Westerners, of his aspirations and failures, his dreams and defections? Marlowe has a lot invested in Jim and in his attempts as narrative recuperation and evaluation. For surely Jim was one of us. And yet, mutatis mutandis. Much of this is paralleled in the relationship of the bondsman narrator Nick with the enigmatic Gatsby. Is Gatsby criminal or romantic? Criminal and romantic. What are the implications for us? For us Americans, of his grandiose plans and their dubious grounding? Of his glamorous dreams and the foul dust that inevitably floated in the wake of his dreams? And in his wretched wake and from them? Nick has a lot, invested in Gatsby and in his own written attempt at the retrieval and, indeed, a Lijak celebration of the man. They're a rotten crowd. You're worth the whole damn bunch put together. So they are. And so, Nick can make us feel he is. For surely America can produce something better than Buchanan's, more splendid than Carraway's. And yet... The extent to which the book is Nick's version can hardly be overstressed. To be sure, he assembles his material from different sources. In addition to his own memory, there are documents, like the youthful Gatsby's copy of Hopalong Cassidy, with its Franklin-esque schedule on the flyleaf, and Nick's own infinitely suggestive list of Gatsby's guests of the summer of 1922, which is now disintegrating at the folds, suggesting perhaps the inevitable disintegration of other depositories of time, including the memory of the narrator. Then there is the long oral account of the first phase of the relationship between Gatsby and Daisy, given to him by Jordan Baker, and the accounts of Gatsby's early life, Dan Cody, and the war years given to him by Gatsby himself, during the doomed and hopeless vigil after the night of the fatal road accident. But it is Nick who transcribes these accounts. How much he may be requoting his sources, and how much translating them, transforming, embellishing, amplifying, rewording, we can never know. By the conventions of fictional narrative, if a narrator gives the words of another character in quotation marks, then these were indeed the very words. He is allowed a slightly implausible perfect recall. Now, by my admittedly rough count, about 4% of the book is in Gatsby's own words, and it is revealing to discover that Fitzgerald considerably reduced the amount of direct speech given to Gatsby in the draft of the novel. For example, "J. Gatsby," he cried suddenly in a ringing voice. "There goes the J. Gatsby. That's what people are going to say. Wait and see." With such outbursts, Gatsby would too crudely and unequivocally have announced and revealed himself. By systematic deletion, Fitzgerald makes Gatsby a far more shadowy, less knowable, more ultimately elusive figure. Instead, we get more of Nick's hypothesizing, speculating, imagining, and perhaps suppressing, recasting, fantasizing. His account is constantly marked by such words and phrases as the following: "I suppose," "I suspect," "I think," "possibly, probably, perhaps," "I've heard it said," "he seemed to say," "there must have been," "I have an idea that," "I always had the impression," as though and as if, used over 60 times, constantly introduce his own transforming similes and metamorphosing metaphors into the account. Possibly it occurred to him, and possibly it didn't. We can never know. What we do know is that it occurs to Nick. However we assess or respond to Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this book, as Nick rather interestingly scruples to spell out. We should always remember that we are responding to what Nick has made of him. From Gatsby's first appearance, a man about my own age, to the moment after Gatsby's death, when Nick is mistaken for Gatsby by a telephone caller, and he subsequently experiences a feeling of defiance, of scornful solidarity between Gatsby and me against them all. We are aware of a strong tendency on Nick's part to identify with Gatsby, as well as to make him a hero. This is why it is so important for him to be able to feel that the account Gatsby gives of his life is all true. Why he is glad to have one of those renewals of complete faith in him that I'd experienced before. Outside business hours, when he is mainly moving around the money that money makes, Nick invests everything in Gatsby. His Gatsby. Nick reveals, or portrays himself, as the very antithesis of Gatsby, as one of Fitzgerald's sad young men. There is some resemblance here to the emotionally timid Lockwood putting together his narrative account of the passionate Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights. I knew the other clerks and young bond salesmen by their first names, and lunched with them in dark, crowded restaurants, on little pig sausages and mashed potatoes and coffee. I even had a short affair with a girl who lived in Jersey City and worked in the accounting department. But her brother began throwing mean looks in my direction, so when she went on her vacation in July, I let it blow quietly away. When it comes to emotional or sexual involvement, what he doesn't let blow quietly away, he blows away himself, as he did an earlier engagement, as does Jordan Baker. He is a self-isolating voyeur. Characteristically, at one point, I was conscious of wanting to look squarely at everyone, and yet, to avoid all eyes. In this, he is like the sexually anxious Isabel Archer in Henry James's portrait of a lady who wants to see, but not to feel. When it comes to the erotic, life in fantasy is safer than real life. I like to walk up Fifth Avenue and pick out romantic women from the crowd, and imagine that in a few minutes I was going to enter into their lives, and no one would ever know or disapprove. Sometimes in my mind, I followed them to their apartments on the corners of hidden streets, and they turned and smiled back at me before they faded through a door into warm darkness. At the enchanted metropolitan twilight, I felt a haunting loneliness sometimes, and felt it in others. Poor young clerks who loitered in front of windows, waiting until it was time for a solitary restaurant dinner. Young clerks in the dusk, wasting the most poignant moments of night and life. As against this, and this is surely dismal, it is perhaps not surprising that Nick looks hungrily for signs of the gorgeous, one of his favoured words, in the life and style of Jay Gatsby. He implies, is everything that Gatsby is not. 30, the promise of a decade of loneliness, a thinning list of single men to know, a thinning briefcase of enthusiasm, thinning hair, thinning everything, as opposed to, and perhaps to compensate for, these gathering attenuations and impoverishments, Gatsby surely embodies more flourishing and fecund, less emotionally ataliated and self-retractive possibilities and potentialities. Nick is a spectator in search of a performer. He sees Gatsby in gestural terms. If personality is an unbroken series of successful gestures, then there was something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life. No little pig sausages and mashed potatoes for Gatsby, not anyway in Nick's version. His own preferred position, on the other hand, observational and non-gestural, is at the margins. At the first party in New York, his instinct is to get out, but he keeps getting entangled and pulled back. Yet, high over the city, our line of yellow windows must have contributed their share of human secrecy to the casual watcher in the darkening streets, and I saw him too, looking up and wondering. I was within and without, simultaneously enchanted and repelled by the inexhaustible variety of life. Whether he knows it or not, he is quoting Whitman almost verbatim, in and out of the game, watching and wondering at it, and wonder, the instinct, the need, the capacity for it, is as important for Nick as it has been for so many American writers. Wondering at often involves and requires distance and betokens a disinclination, if not an incapacity, for participation, a distaste for, if not a fear of, all that sweat and heat and life. No one senses that Nick, for all his regrets, somehow prefers the role of casual watcher in the darkening streets. A difference from Whitman is his almost equal capacity for repulsion. When Nick is not enchanted, he is likely to be starting to feel disgusted. For all the seeming reasonableness and the proffered impartiality of his tone, his Gatsby book is generated by a tendency to move between these extremes. It is a very American oscillation. At the start, Nick puts himself forward, fairly explicitly, as someone with an above-average sense of the fundamental decencies, which now manifests itself as a wish for the world to be in uniform and at a sort of moral attention forever. Could it be that he is briefly attracted to Jordan Baker because, with her male-like, slender and small-breasted body and erect carriage, she looks like a young cadet? Be that as it may, he clearly has something of an authoritarian character with a developed instinct for discipline, hygiene and tidiness, as he readily admits it is part of his engagingness as a narrator. At times he is, I won't say priggish, but a touch prim. He prefers life in some sort of uniform. Indeed, on one occasion, at a peculiarly embarrassing moment at the Buchanan's, he admits, my own instinct was to phone immediately for the police. When he decides to make a clean break with Jordan Baker, he explains in housekeeping terms, I wanted to leave things in order, and not just trust that obliging and indifferent sea to sweep my refuse away. We may note, however, that he didn't mind some unidentified element blowing an earlier involvement away. Nick's manifest dislike of refuse, a slightly obsessive compulsion to clean things up, reveals itself on a number of occasions, of which I will mention two. At the first, drunken, party in New York, as things are disintegrating into increasingly messy incoherence, even though this is one of the two times in his life Nick has allowed himself to get drunk, his fastidious instincts do not fail him. Mr. McKee was asleep on a chair, with his fists clenched in his lap, like a photograph of a man of action. Taking out my handkerchief, I wiped from his cheek the spot of dried lather that had worried me all the afternoon. Shortly after this, Tom Buchanan breaks Myrtle's nose, and the party collapses into terminal chaos. But that's the Buchanans for you. They were careless people. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness, or whatever it was that kept them together, and let other people clear up the mess they had made. Tom brutally spills blood. Nick meticulously wipes off a speck of shaving lather, a tiny fragment of that matter out of place which we call dirt. As well as having a politely controlled instinct to be society's moral policeman, Nick also has it in him to be one of its janitors. The most graphic example of this is what is effectively the last gesture he makes before leaving the East for good. He returns for one more look at Gatsby's huge incoherent failure of a house. On the white steps, an obscene word, scrawled by some boy with a piece of brick, stood out clearly in the moonlight, and I erased it, drawing my shoe raspingly along the stone. Part of his fundamental decency, no doubt, and one can readily share and approve of his instinctive distaste for disrespectful defacement and profanation. But this gesture of erasure has a farther reaching aptness and suggestiveness, While it might be too much to say that Gatsby's actual career, we'll set aside his dreams for the moment, is itself an obscenity. His career, money and identity are clearly grounded in a series of more or less dirty, more or less criminal activities. There are signs that he more than once tries to signal as much to Nick and make him confront and recognise this fact. Nick always refuses. He prefers to erase whatever might be the dirty side of the story, either by omission, denial, overwriting, reinterpretation, or by transformation, though of course it is part of the brilliance of the book. We keep getting glimpses and intimations of what he is trying to keep and write out. For instance, he makes of the early relationship of Gatsby and Daisy a romantic, poetic affair, and it is only subsequently he learns that he took her ravenously and unscrupulously. For the purposes of his book, Nick prefers to concentrate on the figure of the hopeful, hapless dreamer in the pink suit. At one point, he informs us that he is putting down what he has subsequently learned about Gatsby's early life, Dan Cody and so on, to clear this set of misconceptions away, these being the wild and silly rumours that circulated around the enigmatic Gatsby. He certainly clears these away, but it is possible that he clears away, cleans up, much more as well. We take what he tells us about Dan Cody as faithfully transcribed, but what about this as a compressed account of Gatsby's adolescence? But his heart was in a constant, turbulent riot. The most grotesque and fantastic conceits haunted him in his bed at night. A universe of ineffable gaudiness spun itself out in his brain, while the clock ticked on the washstand, and the moon soaked with wet light his tangled clothes upon the floor. Each night he added to his fancies. These reveries provided an outlet for his imagination. They were a satisfactory hint of the unreality of reality, a promise that the rock of the world was founded on a fairy's wing. Who is this? Gatsby or Nick? Or should we by now simply say Nick Gatsby? Gatsby tries to use the light of the moon, dream imagination, to defeat the tick of the clock, history, irreversibility. But Nick also favours moonlight, and he tries to prevent its being fouled and contaminated by the inscribed obscenities of the real. Gatsby provides Nick with an outlet for his imagination. He is Nick's reverie of gaudiness, and seems to offer him a satisfactory, or almost satisfactory, hint of the unreality of reality. The rock of the world is hard and breaks fragile, vulnerable things, as do Tom Buchanan's fists and words. Nick prefers to imagine Gatsby's imagining the world's rock, impossibly taking second place to the fairy's wing, as if anything could be founded on fairy, grounded in gossamer, as we might say. The more general point is that it is invariably impossible to know when Nick is adding or subtracting, to establish when he is amplifying or erasing, to guess when he is simply fantasizing or, more imaginatively, empathetically eliding. On page 1, he tells us that perhaps because of his perceived inclination to reserve all judgments, he unreserves them in this book, he has often been the recipient of intimate revelations of young men, and that he has noted that the terms in which they express these are usually plagiaristic and marred by obvious suppressions. We may thus be alerted early to the possibility that his own intimate revelations, perhaps all such revelations, will also and inevitably be marked by these characteristics as well. Nick may be one of the few honest people he has ever known, but Jordan Baker may not be all wrong when, by way of farewell, she tells him that, in his way, he is another bad driver. Let me put it another way. When Nick first drives out to Wilson's garage in the Valley of Ashes, this is his response. The interior was unprosperous and bare. The only car visible was the dust-covered wreck of a Ford, which crouched in a dim garage. It had occurred to me that this shadow of a garage must be a blind, and that sumptuous and romantic apartments were concealed overhead. Nick cannot tolerate the thought of confronting a reality that is merely poor and bare, dust-covered and wrecked. There must be more than that, a whole hidden dimension of sumptuousness and romance, for which the manifest impoverishment and degradation of the apparitional, the given, are simply a misleading blind, a deceptive mask. But the untranscended bareness of the garage in the Valley of Ashes is real enough, and conceals nothing except a squalid affair. In the Valley of Ashes, what you see is what you get. The phantasmal, sumptuous and romantic apartments provided by the more generous architecture of his imagination, a function at once of his depredation and desire. So that rather than thinking of repression and plagiarism, we might more accurately speak of erasure and supplementation provided by his imagination, and of course, his writing. I want to focus on three examples of the supplementation evident in some of the key lines and passages of the book. One of the many masterstrokes in Fitzgerald's almost uncannily sure-handed, almost inspired, deletions and additions to the gallery proofs of the novel was the insertion of Gatsby's famous comment, "Her voice is full of money." Nick's comment and gloss are remarkable and remarkably revealing. That was it. I'd never understood before. It was full of money. That was the inexhaustible charm that rose and fell in it, the jingle of it, the cymbal song of it. High in a white palace, the king's daughter, the golden girl. Nick is off on a reverie of unsyntactical free association, but one might legitimately feel that that is not it at all, and jingles and cymbals and king's daughters are not at all to the point. Gatsby is more probably intimating that Daisy is a very expensive product, that it takes a great deal of money to make and maintain such a product, that she veritably breathes money, and signalling his awareness of this, Nick prefers to pass over the material base, the rock of the world, and take wing into fairyland. Whatever Gatsby meant by his fine, enigmatic statement, it is Nick who confessedly, from the first, finds Daisy's voice thrilling, full of not money, but excitement and promise. When he speculates, "I think that voice held him most with its fluctuating, feverish warmth because it couldn't be overdreamed," we may perhaps be more certain that it was the voice that held Nick most, because it certainly can be overdreamed, as he later shows in the passage quoted above. As well as being something of a disenchanted moralist, Nick reveals himself to be a quite committed overdreamer. It is by no means a wholly unsympathetic characteristic. At one point, when Nick has entirely taken over Gatsby's story, which he is telling in confident third-person indirect discourse, he indulges himself with this lyrical account. "Out of the corner of his eye, Gatsby saw that the blocks of the sidewalks really formed a ladder and mounted to a secret place above the trees. He could climb to it, if he climbed alone. And once there, he could suck on the pap of life, gulp down the incomparable milk of wonder." His heart beat faster as Daisy's white face came up to his own. He knew that when he kissed this girl, and forever wed his unutterable visions to her perishable breath, his mind would never romp again like the mind of God. So he waited, listening for a moment longer to the tuning fork that had been struck upon a star. Then he kissed her. At his lips' touch, she blossomed for him like a flower, and the incarnation was complete. Through all he said, even though his appalling sentimentality, I was reminded of something, an elusive rhythm, a fragment of lost words that I had heard somewhere a long time ago. For a moment, a phrase tried to take shape in my mouth and my lips parted like a dumb man's, as though there was more struggling upon them than a wisp of startled air. But they made no sound, and what I'd almost remembered was uncommunicable forever. Perhaps the first question to ask is, whose appalling sentimentality? Gatsby, we learned, took Daisy unscrupulously and ravenously, and perhaps did not have much about unutterable visions and perishable breath on his mind. Tuning forks on stars are the stuff of 100 popular songs, and not the best ones at that, and they must be humming in Nick's mind. it is surely the confirmed bachelor Nick, who feels that for maximum gratification, it is better to climb alone. Just as there is surely something regressive about the thought of climbing to a secret place to suck wonder milk from the pap of life. There will be more to say about paps of life and milk of wonder. This hint of nostalgia for the pleasures of childhood is extended by the use of the word romp, and to compare the anarchic and egotistical freedoms and indulgences of the nursery with the mind of God is an audacious attempt to give a religious slant to these regressive yearnings. Whatever Gatsby was thinking when he was courting Daisy, he surely wasn't thinking all this, was he? The question gains force once we discover that at one stage, Fitzgerald added to the gallery proofs 6 pages that made it very clear that the appalling sentimentality was centrally Gatsby's. There is a dialogue between the two men, in which, for instance, when Nick sympathetically says that Daisy is a pretty, satisfactory incarnation of anything, Gatsby says, with far too much clear-eyed resignation, "She is, but it's a little like loving a place where you've once been happy." Even more ruinous would have been the insertion or retention of this self-analytical confession from Gatsby. "But the truth is, I'm empty, and I guess people feel it. Daisy's all I've got left from a world that was so wonderful that when I think of it, I feel sick all over." He looked round with wild regret. "Let me sing you a song. I want to sing you a song. The sound of it makes me happy. But I don't sing it often because I'm afraid I'll use it up." The song? Something he wrote when he was 14. 14. This man's future really is the past, is quoted in full, and amply justifies Nick's comment on his appalling sentimentality. All this disastrous, self-reducing explicitness was unerringly as ever cut. Fitzgerald left in only the last paragraph of the passage quoted above. The deletions increase the unknowability of Gatsby, while the retained paragraph suggests that whatever chord of nostalgia, memory and desire the figure of Gatsby might touch, it remains irrecoverable, uncommunicable, inarticulable, lost, like indeed the American dream. And it is no longer clear where the sentimentality and the regressive impulses are coming from. We sense only that they are in the air of the writing, and the writing is Nick's. Perhaps the following is the most famous paragraph of the book. "I suppose he had the name ready for a long time, even then. His parents were shiftless and unsuccessful farm people. His imagination had never really accepted them as his parents at all. The truth was that J. Gatsby of West Egg, Long Island, sprang from his platonic conception of himself. He was a son of God, a phrase which, if it means anything, means just that, and he must be about his father's business, the service of a vast, vulgar, a meretricious beauty. So he invented just the sort of Jay Gatsby that a 17-year-old boy would be likely to invent. And to this conception, he was faithful to the end." He supposes, but goes on to declare, the truth. This truth that he asserts about Gatsby, and that audaciously, if not blasphemously, invokes the authority of both Plato and God, springs from the fact that Gatsby never accepted his parents as his parents. Like Rudolf Miller, like Fitzgerald himself, and like many another self-parenting figure in the history of America, life and literature. The reasons for this determination, or instinct to reject or deny the parents, more specifically, it is mainly a repudiation of the authority, prescriptive and proscriptive, of fathers, biological or founding, range from the practical to the ideological. I am not so foolish as to suggest that the instinct to deny parents is peculiar American. After all, Freud's family romance would suggest that it is more or less universal, but there is no doubt that it is felt with special force in America. Moreover, it receives specific cultural endorsement and support. Indeed, it is embedded in American literature as something of an obligation and a prerequisite for the achievement of an American identity. Our age is retrospective. It builds the sepulchres of the fathers. So starts Emerson's first work, the enormously influential 1836 essay Nature. Building sepulchres to the fathers is just exactly what Americans should not be doing, as far as Emerson was concerned. Fathers, and fathering countries, like England, are to be forgotten. Why should not we also enjoy an original relation to the universe? The sun shines today also. There are new lands, new men, new thoughts. Emerson and many writers who followed him stressed self-reliance, self-sculpting, self-architecturing, self-inventing. The metaphors are many. The American self-made man had a prestigious legitimation and encouragement. Jay Gatsby is a very American young man. But what about God and Plato? Here, I must bring together a few passages to point up a particular characteristic of Nick's vocabulary. Near the end, after summarising the legal and logistical business that followed the shooting of Gatsby, Nick writes, "But all this part of it seemed remote and unessential." Even nearer the end, he refers to the inessential houses, melting away as the moon rises. Between un and in, as prefixes, expressing negation, there is not much difference. Either way, not essential, not of the essence. When Nick imagines Gatsby's state of mind as he awaits a phone call from Daisy and instead receives a visit from Wilson, he becomes quite metaphysical. I have an idea that Gatsby himself didn't believe it would come, and perhaps he no longer cared. If that was true, he must have felt that he had lost the old warm world, paid a high price for living too long with a single dream. He must have looked up at an unfamiliar sky, through frightening leaves, and shivered as he found what a grotesque thing a rose is, and how raw the sunlight was upon the scarcely created grass. A new world, material without being real, where poor ghosts, breathing dreams like air, drifted fortuitously about. Like that ashen, fantastic figure gliding toward him through the amethyst trees. Material without being real is a straightforward Neoplatonic distinction. The really real is to be found or sought in the realm of unchanging ideas or forms. But Nick is transcribing something more like a moment of existential panic, such as is described by Sartre in Le Nausée, when Requentin, staring at a tree, experiences a terrible sense of the sheer, absurd, horrible gratuitousness of things, a negative epiphany in which matter without meaning turns monstrous, frightening, grotesque. To Gatsby, thinks Nick, this is how the world empty and bereft of his dream of Daisy must have appeared. To Nick, perhaps, this is how the world without Gatsby, and thus without Gatsby's tenacious but doomed dreaming, is beginning to look. This passage is followed by Nick's description of what he saw when they hurried down to the pool in which Gatsby had been shot. There was a faint, barely perceptible movement of the water, as the fresh flow from one end urged its way towards the drain at the other, with little ripples that were hardly the shadows of waves. The laden mattress moved irregularly down the pool. A small gust of wind that scarcely corrugated the surface was enough to disturb its accidental course with its accidental burden. In a book in which there is much bad driving and so many accidents, including the fatal one, that precipitates the catastrophic conclusion, the italicized word is highly appropriate. But the deliberate repetition serves to remind us of the more general, philosophical meaning of the word. Exactly, not essential. Nick tells us that when Gatsby met Daisy, he found himself in her house by a colossal accident. Wittingly or not, he has chosen an ominously apt phrase, for their relationship also ends with, and by, a colossal accident, of a more horribly literal kind. Was it all an accidental matter, from beginning to end? Now that Gatsby is dead, it would seem that Nick feels he is confronting a wholly contingent world. Inessential. Unessential. When Tom Buchanan, confident that he has exposed Gatsby as a common criminal, contemptuously dismisses Gatsby and Daisy to drive back together, Nick writes, "They were gone, without a word. Snapped out. Made accidental." In a world dominated by Buchanans, pure contingency reigns. Frightening. Grotesque. During the reunion of Gatsby and Daisy, recounted at the very centre of the book, according to Nick Gatsby, sometimes stared around at his possessions in a dazed way, as though, in her actual and astounding presence, none of it was any longer real. More filtered Neoplatonism, with the higher actual ideal, displacing and devaluing, indeed, effectively dematerialising the merely materially real. No wonder that Gatsby feels momentarily, ontologically, all at sea. Once he nearly toppled down a flight of stairs. Where Gatsby is concerned, just what is real and where it is to be found becomes problematical, surprising. There is a marvellous scene in which the slightly drunk guest with the owl-eyed spectacles, whom Nick and Jordan come across in Gatsby's library, begins to eulogise admiringly. "What do you think about that?" he demanded impetuously. "About what?" He waved his hand toward the bookshelves. "About that. As a matter of fact, you needn't bother to ascertain. I ascertained. They're real." "The books?" He nodded. "Absolutely real. Half pages and everything. I thought they'd be a nice durable cardboard. Matter of fact, they're absolutely real. Pages, and here, let me show you." Taking our scepticism for granted, he rushed to the bookcases and returned with volume one of the Stoddard Lectures. "See," he cried triumphantly. "It's a bona fide piece of printed matter. It fooled me. This fella's a regular Belasco. It's a triumph. What thoroughness. What realism. Knew when to stop too. Didn't cut the pages. But what do you want? What do you expect?" David Belasco was a Broadway producer, famous for the realism of his sets. Gatsby theatricalizes himself and his surroundings, and it is often difficult to know which parts of the show, how much of what he shows, is real. It can happen that just where you expect, or suspect, the most obvious artifice and artificiality, in the books in his library, say, or in his embarrassingly cliched account of his life, which does not so much challenge credulity as defy it, you find you have stumbled into authenticity. They're real, absolutely real. Then it was all true. Perhaps then we should look for the real where we might least expect it, ready, in the case of Gatsby, perhaps in the case of America, to discern merit in meretriciousness, value in the vulgar. It is worth pausing briefly on the word absolutely. It is the first word Jordan Baker says in the opening scene, so, seemingly apropos of nothing, it makes Nick jump. "She is also," she says, "absolutely in training. Is this absolutely where you live, my dearest one?" Daisy gaily asks Nick, as they approach Gatsby's house, and on another occasion, she indeed calls Nick an absolute rose. A less appropriate description of the somewhat prim and shrinking wallflower, Nick, it would be hard to imagine. Clearly, absolutely has here become one of the most empty words that make up part of the bantering argot of a particular social set, or indeed period, and is conceptually meaningless. so we should not lean too heavily on the word, nor hear too much in it. When the man in the owl-eyed spectacles remarks in some amazement on the absolute reality of Gatsby's books. But clearly, there is in Nick's narrative discourse a hunger for something absolute, something essential, something that is real in a more than contingent, material, accidental way. There is a theological and metaphysical yearning, confused and vestigial though it may be, mixed up with Nick's desire to believe in some form or figure of gorgeousness to offset the dismalness with which he is all too and now increasingly familiar, which is why he deliberately and daringly invokes God and Plato in his celebratory elegy of the sentimental American criminal in the pink rag of a suit. At the end of Thomas Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49, the heroine, Oedipa Marr, has come to a personal crisis that also involves no less than the meaning of America itself. Another mode of meaning behind the obvious or not, either Oedipa, in the orbiting ecstasy of a true paranoia, or a real Tristero. For there was either some Tristero beyond the appearance of legacy America, or there was just America. And if there was just America, then it seemed the only way she could continue and managed to be at all relevant to it, was as an alien, unfurrowed, assumed, full circle, into some paranoia. Nick is no Oedipa, and Gatsby is not the Tristero, an ambiguous secret society, operating beyond or beneath the reach of the official established power structures. But there is a similarity in the stance, and the need, and the perceived alternatives, that is recognisable and may be found throughout American literature. From the time of the Puritans, the idea that it might be just America has been felt to be intolerable and unacceptable. There must be another mode of meaning behind the obvious. You may discover and assert it the Puritan way, God, or the transcendentalist way, Plato, but one way or another, the urge to do so, or fear of being unable to do so, is recurrent. It drives and worries Nick, as it does Oedipa Marr's. And while Nick gives no indication of having recourse to Oedipa's alternative of paranoia, it could be argued that he finds a refuge in writing and fantasy to console himself in a post-Gatsby world. He catches glimpses of some of the uglier and more sordid social, sexual, and economic realities of the story he has to tell, but he refuses to let them dominate his narrative as they do life. If they did, there would be just America. Consequently, writes Richard Godden, whenever the contradictions within his subject become too disquieting, he turns social aspiration into dream, sexual politics into romance, and translates class conflict as tragedy. When Nick is introducing himself to us, he speaks about his family with such casual, disarming honesty that it is easy to overlook the implications of what he reveals. My family have been prominent, well-to-do people in this middle western city for three generations. The Carraways are something of a clan, and we have a tradition that we're descended from the Dukes of Buccleuch. But the actual founder of my line was my grandfather's brother, who came here in 51, sent a substitute to the Civil War, and started the wholesale hardware business that my father carries on today. Underneath the cosmetic vocabulary of clan, tradition, dukes, etc., this actual is a pretty inglorious, cowardly, materially opportunistic affair. Towards the end of the American scene, Henry James, having visited the old town of St. Augustine in Florida, recalls how the magazine illustrators had contrived, or conspired, to give the town an intensely romantic character, investing it, quite falsely, with all sorts of vistas and attributes of Spanish antiquity. This sets James musing. It points so vividly the homely moral that when you haven't what you like, you must perforce like, and above all, misrepresent what you have. The guardians of real values struck me as up and down, far to seek. The whole matter indeed would seem to come back, interestingly enough, to the general truth of the aesthetic need in the country for much greater values of certain sorts than the country in its manners, its aspects and arrangements, its past and present, and perhaps even future, really supply, whereby, as the aesthetic need, is also intermixed with a patriotic yearning, a supply has somehow to be extemporised by any pardonable form of pictorial hanky-panky, has to be, as the expression goes, cleverly faked. The novelists improvise, with the aid of the historians, a romantic local past of costume, and compliment and swordplay, and gallantry and passion. The dramatists build up, of 1,000 pieces, the airy fiction that the life of the people among whom the elements of clash and contrast, as simplest and most superficial, abounds in the subjects and situations and effects of the theatre. While the genealogists touch up the picture with their pleasant hint of the number, over the land, of families of royal blood. It is the public these appearances collectively refer us to that becomes thus again the more attaching subject. The public so placidly uncritical that the whitest thread of the deceptive stitch never makes it blink, and sentimental at once with such inveteracy and such simplicity that finding everything everywhere perfectly splendid, it fairly goes upon its knees to be humbuggingly humbug. Nick certainly doesn't find everything everywhere perfectly splendid, and I would never for a moment suggest that even in the most metaphorical way he ever goes upon his knees before Gatsby to be humbuggingly humbugged. But there is about him just a touch of the novelist and dramatist James describes, and once or twice he makes a point of not blinking at the white threads of some fairly visible, deceptive stitches. And if he himself refuses to go along with the sort of genealogical hanky-panky that apparently prevails in his family, rather indeed blowing the whistle on it, albeit in passing, he nevertheless reveals or conjures up a society tolerably permeated with hanky-panky, not to say misrepresentation and fakery of many kinds. There is certainly a lot of visible architectural hanky-panky, starting with Gatsby's own mansion, which is a factual imitation of some Hotel de Ville in Normandy. In the ambiguous atmosphere in which Gatsby moves and operates, factual imitations cannot easily be distinguished from imitation facts. If you fix the World Series, you have created an imitation fact. Gatsby knows the man who did it. That is part of the company he keeps. The mansion has a tower that is, as Nick's often entirely unhumbugged eyes notes, spanking new under a thin beard of raw ivy. This perfectly exemplifies the practice of misrepresentation, the hanky-panky and fakery that earn James strictures, the crude superimposition of a false veneer of antiquity, the thin beard of raw ivy, on the spanking newness of, well, of America, James would say. This desire to affix a prestigious patina of pastness to a less obviously distinguished present can spring from many sources. Gatsby didn't build his phony French mansion. It was commissioned a decade earlier by a brewer who took his passion to reimpose an alien pastness on the new American landscape to extreme lengths. There was a story that he'd agreed to pay 5 years' taxes on all the neighbourhood cottages if the owners would have their roofs thatched with straw. They wouldn't, and he died. Crazy indeed, but Gatsby, also in his own way, seeks to repeat the past. Why, of course you can. Things aren't so different over on more fashionable East Egg. The Buchanans live in a red and white Georgian colonial mansion with an Italian garden. Tom certainly has the worst kind of colonizing mentality. All others exist only to satisfy his needs and appetites. But he is no more grounded in, or significantly related to, ancient American history than Gatsby. This house originally belonged to Dumaine, the oilman, and one can see how deftly, yet unobtrusively, Fitzgerald makes his points. A brewer and an oilman. The money that could afford to erect these grandiose architectural masks, drawing on Europe and history for facades at once to cover and dignify the origins of their wealth, is derived from alcohol and oil, two of the basic, raw materials that indeed served to fuel much of American society, moving both the economy and the people in different and dangerous ways. Think how much of this novel is taken up with drinking and driving, and drunken driving. Later in the novel, Tom boasts that while you often hear of people making a garage out of a stable, he is the first man to make a stable out of a garage. It is a suggestive conversion. Once you have made enough money, let's say in oil, you can thatch it over with your preferred pastoral fakery. Of course, there are many, many American garages that are doomed to remain always and only garages, unprofitable, unconvertible, irredeemable. Ask Wilson in the Valley of Ashes. There is more decorative hanky-panky in the book, the tapestried furniture covered with scenes of ladies swinging in the gardens of Versailles, in Myrtle's apartment, for example. But enough has been noted to indicate that Fitzgerald gives us glimpses of a country where the past is pretty thin on the ground, and of a society in which people, once they can afford to, reach out eclectically for all kinds of imported facades, exotic, historic, to cover not just the naked facts of how they make or made their money, which is not unique to them, Victorian England did it too, but also their spanking newness. There is a nice moment recorded by Nick, who shortly after arriving in West Egg is feeling alone and new when a stranger asks him the way to the village. I told him, and as I walked on, I was lonely no longer. I was a guide, a pathfinder, an original settler. This is Nick's tone at its most sympathetic, a kind of tasteful exaggeration that contrives to be at once playful and modest. But in the lightest of ways, he is touching on a matter of great import. His instant transformation from lonely newcomer to original settler is a comic version of something that has concerned Americans in various ways since the first settlements. As the inhabitants of America, once the Indians had been effectively erased, have all been in a sense displaced newcomers, they have always wanted to originate themselves somehow in America. They have conducted a search, let us call it, for modes of more or less instant racination. In their agnostic confrontation, Tom derides Gatsby as Mr. Nobody from Nowhere. He is talking defensive gibberish at the time, as Nick notes, but the phrase does pose an implicit question. Can anybody in this book be said to be Mr. or Ms. Somebody from Somewhere? They are all restless nomads from the Midwest, simply with more or less money. Restlessness is the predominant mood of the novel, and the word and its variants occur frequently. There is no "they're there," said Gertrude Steen of Oakland. One might not unfairly extend the remark to cover the America of this book. "I didn't want you to think I was just some nobody," said Gatsby to Nick in their first real conversation, explaining why he has ventured to tell him his life story to date. And if any of these nobodies, driving from nowhere to nowhere, does become somebody, then by the grace of Nick's text, it is Gatsby, the great Gatsby. But how and why great? And how much of Gatsby is hanky-panky? Does Nick, to any extent, allow himself to be humbuggingly humbugged? There is a most revealing exchange between the two men at the start of their first conversation and Gatsby's life story. "I'll tell you God's truth." His right hand suddenly ordered divine retribution to stand by. "I am the son of some wealthy people in the Middle West, all dead now. I was brought up in America, but educated at Oxford, because all my ancestors have been educated there for many years. It is a family tradition." He looked at me sideways, and I knew why Jordan Baker had believed he was lying. He hurried the phrase, "educated at Oxford," or swallowed it, or choked on it, as though it had bothered him before. And with this doubt, his whole statement fell to pieces, and I wondered if there wasn't something a little sinister about him after all. "What part of the Middle West?" I inquired casually. "San Francisco." "I see. My family all died, and I came into a good deal of money." His voice was solemn, as if the memory of that sudden extinction of a clan still haunted him. For a moment, I suspected that he was pulling my leg, but a glance at him convinced me otherwise. Incurably dishonest herself, we may perhaps expect Jordan Baker to know a liar when she hears one. And indeed, most of this part of Gatsby's story is pure hanky-panky, even if the armistice did give him 5, not in the ancestral family tradition, months at Oxford. The question is, how much does he expect to be believed? The invoking of God and the theatrical gesture with the right hand, followed by the sideways look. Of course, his statement falls to pieces, but something odder follows. When he puts San Francisco in the Middle West, rather as if, in Britain, someone told you he came from Glasgow in the Midlands, Nick simply says, "I see." Now at this point, Gatsby is surely showing Nick the white thread of the deceptive stitch, and Nick chooses not to see it, or rather not to acknowledge or draw attention to it. There is a way of saying, "I see," it is probably Nick's way, that tacitly states, "I know you're lying, and I know, you know you're lying. But for my own reasons, perhaps politeness, perhaps embarrassment at such brazen mendacity, perhaps something more inscrutable, I chose not to challenge your statement." It is exactly what Nick says again, when Gatsby suddenly and inexplicably dismisses his former staff and fills his house with a bunch of deliberately rude and villainous-looking thugs. Gatsby explains, "They're all brothers and sisters. They used to run a small hotel." This surely is another exposure of the deceptive white thread. I think Richard Godden is absolutely right to suggest that with this sudden and crude termination of his lavish, star-studded, hyper-elegant, conspicuously consuming summer parties, Gatsby is deliberately showing Nick, and perhaps indirectly Daisy, his real milieu, his actual criminal grounding, really rubbing his nose in it, as it were. Nick sees, but chooses not to see, or rather, chooses to concentrate on seeing something else. As Nick has revealed, he knows a thing or two about families inventing ancestors and traditions, and he even extends to Gatsby's relatives his preferred and rather pretentious word, clan, and more, inappropriate appellation, surely, for Gatsby's shiftless and unsuccessful farm people, even than for the war-dodging Carraways. It is as if a part of him at least is prepared to participate in Gatsby's hanky-panky. It runs in the family, we might say. Another part of him knows very well that he is having his leg pulled. Gatsby could hardly have tipped him a more visible wink, but he is extraordinarily quick to be convinced otherwise. We may see this as eager credulity or engaging trust, constant suspicion, and a wary determination never to be taken in, and not the most attractive of characteristics. And there is something sympathetic in Nick's tremendous keenness to give Gatsby the benefit of the doubt. How much this is generosity prompted by attraction to the man and revulsion from others, and how much is collusion, the willing suspension of disbelief motivated by a desire for the gorgeous, would be impossible to determine. What is clear is that faced with the Buchanans of this world, Nick will go along with Gatsby's hanky-panky, will indeed justify, amplify, and celebrate it in his writing. He is certainly loyal to him to the end, taking charge of his exequies at that sad funeral, to which an ungrateful and forgetful nobody comes, except for a few servants, his pathetic father, who like a hog, and the man in owl-shaped spectacles, who wondered at the absolute reality of Gatsby's books, and who pronounces one of his epitaphs, "The poor son of a bitch." Nick will write a more oncomiastic commemoration. While waiting for proofs in Rome, Fitzgerald wrote to Maxwell Perkins. Strange to say, my notion of Gatsby's vagueness was okay. I myself didn't know what Gatsby looked like or was engaged in. Anyhow, after careful searching of the files of a man's mind here, I know Gatsby better than I know my own child. My first instinct was to let him go and have Tom Buchanan dominate the book, but Gatsby sticks in my heart. I had him for a while, then lost him, and now I know I have him again. And in a letter to John Peel Bishop a little later, "You are right about Gatsby being blurred and patchy. I never at any one time saw him clear myself." This is all exactly right. Nick has Gatsby, loses him, then has him again in a different way. More generally, now you see Gatsby, now you don't. On more than one occasion, Nick looks for Gatsby, only to find him not there. And of course, he does not even appear until chapter 3, a quarter of the way into the book, and disappears before the end. In a way, Tom does dominate the book. He dominates everyone and everything, and Nick drinks with him before he meets Gatsby, and shakes his hand after Gatsby's death. Buchanans, as a type, go on forever, survive everything. Gatsby, for all his connections, is frailer and more vulnerable. And in a more general, epistemological sense, he is and remains, for us the readers too, vague as to what he is and what he does. As we have seen, Fitzgerald deliberately contributed to his vagueness by cutting out too explicit dialogue. And this was not a matter of, as it were, withholding information in the interests of mystification. That strange hint of ontological insubstantiality about him is absolutely crucial. Of a look that passes over Gatsby's face while Tom is insulting him, Nick states that it was definitely unfamiliar and vaguely recognisable. Notice the perfection, for suggestivity, of the apparent oxymorons. The recognisability is vague, but the unfamiliarity is definite. Gatsby looms and fades, sharpens and blurs. Now you see him, you think, and now you don't. You are almost sure. This wonderfully maintained vagueness is better than okay. It is an essential part of the magic of the book. For even after the harshest scrutiny of the figure of Gatsby, which might reduce him to a sentimental roughneck, a criminal with a soppy dream, a ruthless social climber, determined to buy himself a very classy piece of female goods, Gatsby does, somehow, stick in the heart. At times, when he does appear, he reminds people of a popular journal or an advertisement. My incredulity was submerged in fascination now. It was like skimming hastily through a dozen magazines, writes Nick of his response to Gatsby's life story. You resemble the advertisement of the man. You know the advertisement of the man. Daisy doesn't finish her sentence. Presumably he looks like the man in any number of advertisements. Jordan Baker is said to look like a good illustration. The effects are everywhere. In today's parlance, we might say that he sometimes strikes people as being all simulacra. Advertising was booming in the America of the 20s. Gatsby is very much a child of his culture, and equips and surrounds himself with all the most fashionable and flamboyant commodities, from shirts to cars. The formal note, with the signature in a majestic hand, with which he first announces himself to Nick, is the first sign of his careful self-fashioning. And observe how quick Nick is to pick up hints of regality in this democratic republic. In a way, his ostentatious house and expensive parties are an elaborate advertising display designed to impress Daisy. His certainty that he can repeat the past, his confidence that he can fix everything just the way it was, owes a lot to this advertising culture. In the book, I have referred to Richard Godden details how Henry Ford, in 1922, recreated his old home exactly as it had been 60 years earlier. In the marketplace, time is irreversible, Godden comments. In reality, of course, his dream founders on his impossible insistence that time can be not only reversed, but erased. He has lost Daisy and Dream. From the moment he tries to make her tell Tom that she had never loved him, and it's all wiped out forever. You can wipe away graffiti and stray shaving soap, but not time. Time is the one thing Gatsby cannot fix. He cannot even handle it very well. In the central chapter of the book, 5, when he meets Daisy again, he nearly knocks over a clock. This clock happens to be defunct, which perhaps makes it a fitting adjunct and material witness to the attempt he is making to stop time. But elsewhere, the clocks are ticking like mad. There is an unusually large number of time words in the novel, over 400. It is no wonder that he looks at Daisy's child with surprise. I don't think he had ever really believed in its existence before. And Tom has only to cite the times and places of his sexual possession of Daisy, and Gatsby is pretty well done for. I should say Gatsby, J. Gatsby, had broken up like glass against Tom's hard malice, and the long secret extravaganza was played out. His constructed identity, the simulacrum, which has been buoyed up and motivated by the cherished notion of a recapturable, repurchasable Daisy and an erasable time, is in ruin. Daisy stays bought. So, is great an irony or a wishful hyperbole that recoils on itself? Is the whole work the self-consoling hanky-panky of a miserable failure of a bachelor who invents a gorgeous figure to compensate for the dismal Middle West to which he has retreated? Nick's fakery? Of Gatsby's fakery? This cannot be all there is to it, although I believe that there are those who think so. To the extent that it is this, we know it from Nick himself. Just as Gatsby occasionally shows him the white thread of the deceptive stitch, so Nick does to the attentive reader. There is more to Gatsby than the shivered glass of his custom-made identity after his shattering encounter with Tom's rock at its most obdurate, something that in the end he inadequately articulates and imperfectly incarnates, but is indeed part of the essence of that self-inventing, self-parented nation of which he is at once so remarkable and so representative a product. We may call it, with Nick, an extraordinary gift for hope, a romantic readiness, an adherence to, or gesturing towards, a conviction or a feeling that there must be something more to life than the corruption that surrounds and attends Gatsby. The appetitive, self-gratifying, sheer, mere materiality in which the Buchanans are so heedlessly at home. That this hope takes the forms of a romantic dream or impossible obsession, which is at once doomed and unrealizable, does not necessarily invalidate the need or desire that nourished it. If the colossal vitality of his illusion does finally go beyond everything, and thus must perforce be disappointed and come to naught, it does not mean that the devitalizing lifelessness that may result from determined disillusion necessarily offers the better way. It does mean that there is a special kind of sadness to the book. For there is pathos, as well as, if you like, puerility, about Gatsby. His aura of loneliness and isolation, the emptiness that seems to flow from his house, his piles of beautiful shirts, his always unappreciated generosity, no thanks for covering for Daisy, which cost him his life, his mean death and unattended funeral. And to the extent that Gatsby is excessive, foolish and foredormed, so the whole book suggests is America. Not long before the novel was published, Fitzgerald wrote to Mario Manes, "America's greatest promise is that something is going to happen, and after a while, you get tired of waiting, because nothing happens to people except that they grow old, and nothing happens to American art, because America is the story of the moon that never rose." When the moon famously does rise at the end of The Great Gatsby, it prompts one of the most famous paragraphs in American literature. "The inessential houses began to melt away, until gradually I became aware of the old island here that flowered once for Dutch sailors' eyes, a fresh, green breast of the New World. Its vanished trees, the trees that had made way for Gatsby's house, at once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of human dreams. For a transitory, enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood or desired, face to face for the last time in history, with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder." This passage was originally at the end of chapter 1, until, with another of those unerring corrections, Fitzgerald moved it to the end, the dusk of the narrative, where its crepuscular tone is so fitting. The original early positioning indicates that the book was always going to be an elegy, pervaded with a sense of something muffed, something lost, a chance missed, a dream doomed. The green breast of the New World, the pap of a possible new life, might have offered an inexhaustible supply of the milk of wonder. But whatever the sailors came for, all the sailors, from Puritans to pirates, they came not to wonder at America, but rather, in various ways, to rape it. To use William Carlos Williams' metaphor for the various and multiple spoliations of the American land. The green breast of the New World has given way, as an image, to the shocking spectacle of Myrtle's left breast, swinging loose like a flap after the road accident. Fitzgerald was very insistent about retaining this spectacle. "I want Myrtle Wilson's breast ripped off. It's exactly the thing I think." Fitzgerald knows, of course, exactly what he is doing. He wants to show America desecrated, mutilated, violated. Whatever the might have beens of the New World, and the incoherent, hopeful yet hopeless reachings out of a Gatsby, perhaps offer a vague, vestigial and distorted hint of a kind of gladly accepted capacity for wonder, desired if not fully understood, that might have made something better out of the great last chance that was America. America has contrived to make itself utterly accidental and accident prone. Of what might have been a wonderland, a theme endemic to American literature suggests, we have made a wasteland. Fitzgerald knew T.S. Eliot's poem of that name pretty much by heart, and of course he created his own wasteland in the Valley of Ashes, a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat into ridges and hills and grotesque gardens, where ashes take the forms of houses and chimneys, and finally, with a transcendent effort, of ash-grey men who move dimly and already crumbling through the powdery air. Occasionally a line of grey cars crawls along an invisible track, gives out a ghastly creak, and comes to rest. Transcendent is a peculiarly loaded word in America, and it is used here with dark irony. This is negative transcendence, a travesty, the very reverse of what Emerson and his friends had hoped for America, with the land actually producing, growing, ashes. Fitzgerald was neither the first nor the last American writer to have an entropic vision of America. The great agrarian continent turning itself into some sort of terminal rubbish heap or wasteland where, with ultimate perversity, the only thing that grows is death. Fitzgerald was canny enough to associate this process with the exponential spread of the automobile. As already noted, the book is full of cars, bad driving and accidents, and together they conspire to kill not only people, but the land itself. Bad driver Jordan Baker's very name is composed of the brand names of two automobiles. Aptly, Fitzgerald places the garage, Wilson's garage, but let us say the generic garage, at the heart of the valley of ashes that it is producing. Henry Adams, who was the first American writer to employ the word entropy to describe the future he foresaw, related this predicted accelerating entropy to the rapid increase of new discovery of sources of energy and power, coupled with a decrease in the human ability to control it. In his Education, he wrote, "Power leaped from every atom, and enough of it to supply the stellar universe showed itself run into waste at every pore of matter. Man could no longer hold it off. Buses grasped his wrists and flung him about as though he had hold of a live wire or a runaway automobile," which was very nearly the exact truth for the purposes of an elderly and timid single gentleman in Paris, who never drove down the Champs-Élysées without expecting an accident and commonly witnessing one, or found himself in the neighbourhood of an official without calculating the chances of a bomb. So long as the rates of progress held good, these bombs would double in number and force every 10 years. Fitzgerald chose to double up on the automobile accidents. A contemporary writer might prefer to go for bombs. Overlooking, though not overseeing, the Valley of Ashes are, of course, the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. The eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg are blue and gigantic. Their retinas are 1 yard high. They look out of no face, but instead from a pair of enormous yellow spectacles which pass over a non-existent nose. Evidently, some wild wag of an occultist set them there to fatten his practice in the borough of Queens, and then sank down himself into eternal blindness, or forget them and moved away. But his eyes, dimmed a little by many paintless days under sun and rain, brood on over the solemn dumping ground. André Laveau has most sensitively traced the various subtle ways in which Fitzgerald deploys colours, above all blue and yellow. As Laveau points out, blue is water, the sky, twilight, cool, restful, inviting. Yellow is wheat, sunshine, and fertility, but also whiskey, gold, and dead combustible straw, and is thus ambiguous, for what seems attractive and warm may turn combustible, violent, too hot. Tom is straw-haired. Ideally, the two colours, and all they evoke, should be in harmony with each other, as in Nick's odd but suggestive phrase, "the blue honey of the Mediterranean." But in this book they seem to drift apart, and tend to opposition. Misleadingly, perhaps, Gatsby's car is yellow, though it is part of the dubiety that surrounds him that people disagree about the colour. One describes it as cream-coloured, another light green. Like its owner, it appears differently in different lights. While Tom's convertible is blue. But appropriately, they exchange cars at Tom's insistence, when their struggle over Daisy heads for climax and showdown. To return to Dr. T.J. Eckelberg, to the extent that his blue eyes are fading and dimming a little, while the yellow spectacles persist untarnished. This may intimate, as Laveau suggests, a withering of spiritual power and a corresponding increase in materialism. Spectacles are designed to help you see better. But see what? See how? For Nick, after Gatsby's death, the East was haunted, distorted beyond my eyes. Power of correction. So he retreats, one might be tempted to say, regresses, back home, which at the start of his narrative seemed like the ragged edge of the universe, but is now again, perhaps, the warm centre of the world. The wild wagger cultist, whom Nick posits, and who has also absented himself from the area, may be an allusion to a god who should oversee the world, but who has become a deus absconditus, or who no longer cares to turn his eyes on man in the wasteland he has made, or who may simply be dead, having left behind what man hath made, an advertisement. After the accident, Michaelis is shocked to see that while Wilson is invoking God, he is looking at the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. God sees everything, repeated Wilson. That's an advertisement, Michaelis assured him. Whatever may have been the religious intentions and aspirations of the original Puritan settlers, the landscape is now dominated entirely by commercial and material considerations, though religious and commercial concerns may have been linked from the start. In America's Coming of Age, Van Wyck Brooks suggests that this is so. Thus, the literature of the 17th century in America is composed in equal parts, one might fairly say, of piety and advertisement. As we have seen, Gatsby lives in and through an advertising world, and is something of a composite advertisement himself. The question, perhaps, is whether his gestures, which result from and express, thinks Nick, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life, are indicative of an inchoate form of a piety all his own. When Nick says that the East is haunted for me like that, distorted beyond my eyes, power of correction, that refers to a night scene by El Greco. El Greco is famous for his elongations and what some might call his feverish exaggerations. Since, by Nick's own confession, his vision of what happened is uncorrected and uncorrectable, we should perhaps take the hint, intended or not, that he has given us an El Greco-ish version, heightened, enlarged, excitably glorified, of Gatsby and what surrounded him. But El Greco, like Vermeer, who we may regard as much less inclined to distortion than El Greco, indeed, as painting with as miraculously a correct vision as is possible to attain, is an artist, and all art involves distortion, selection, interpretation, amplification. It could be argued that distortion is inseparable from representation. Whatever the motivation for Nick's writing, even if it was simply a winter dream to occupy and console him in the dismal fastness of the Middle West, he has still delivered a work of art, and there can never be any unravelling of the motives that lie behind the making of a work of art. It is Fitzgerald's book, of course, and in showing us Nick working on the problems and pitfalls involved in seeing his material, working out his way of writing Gatsby, both faking and fating him, Fitzgerald added a whole new dimension to his work. Henry James once wrote, "There is the story of one's hero, and then, thanks to the intimate connection of things, the story of one's story itself." And given us not only the story of Gatsby, but the story of Nick trying to write that story, Fitzgerald confronts no less a problem than what might be involved, what might be at stake, in trying to see, and write, America itself. The result is short, those inspired excitations. Deceptively simple, with something of the lean, yet pregnant economy of a parable. For a book so explicitly rooted in the 20s, it contains, as Matthew Broccoli has noted, surprisingly little in the way of sociological or anthropological data. It is word perfect and inexhaustible. The Great Gatsby is, I believe, the most perfectly crafted work of fiction to come out of America. When Nick attends his first party at Gatsby's mansion, he is on guard against its spectroscopic gaiety. He finds some things graceless, others vacuous. After two glasses of champagne, the scene had changed before my eyes into something significant, elemental and profound. There is a touch of self-mockery in the knowing exaggeration, if that's all it takes. A critic, such as Richard Godden, might say that the champagne is pretty flat. But this, I think, is to miss something of the undoubted magic of the book and its irreducible polyvalency. Call it undecidability. Some days the car is yellow, on others it looks light green. At times Gatsby may stick in your throat, as well as your heart. Perhaps he is like the books in his library, absolutely real, where you most expect him to be fake. Finally, absolutely unreadable, because his inner pages are uncut. But what do you want? What do you expect?